They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I am constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello and welcome to the SpedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, August 19th, 2024, we're delighted to host New Voices and Administrative Law 2, discussing the Supreme Court and federal court jurisdiction. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we'll keep the introduction of our guests today brief. But if you'd like to know more about any of our speakers, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Professor Aram Gavoor. Professor Gavoor is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the George Washington University Law School and an internationally recognized public law scholar. Relevant to today's discussion, Professor Gavoor has taught courses and published scholarship on federal courts and constitutional law for years. Earlier in his career, he spent over a decade leading federal appellate and trial-level litigations that implicated jurisdictional questions at the U.S. Department of Justice. And I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Professor Gavoor, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Kayla, and thanks to the Society for putting this on. I'm a deputy chair of the Admin Law and Regulation Practice Group, and this is a great event. It's a second of its kind and a tradition of sorts. We're really trying to platform some of our best and brightest who have recently graduated from law school on issues of general interest and their topical competence. So today we're really going to be focusing on just the state of federal court jurisdiction based on the several past couple terms with the Supreme Court. So in law school, we teach standing as requiring under Article 3, Section 2, a case or a controversy that is actual or imminent, not hypothetical or conjectural. It has to be concrete and particularized, and there must be causation and redressability. But the standing jurisprudence, as it's known, largely came about in the 1970s with the enlargement of the administrative state, with the New Deal era and the 1960s agencies growing and growing, providing more regulation for subject matter in day-to-day American life. Standing jurisprudence needed to expand and define itself with a number of significant cases. So Adamso versus Camp and a number of others. Bringing into the fore economic injury as a basis for sufficiently injurious conduct. So what we'll do here is I will briefly introduce our three panelists, give them time to share with you their thoughts with regard to the past couple terms with the Supreme Court and standing, and then we'll have a nice lively conversation. So first up, we have Eric Bush. He's a law clerk for the Honorable Justin R. Walker, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. He graduated from Harvard Law School, where he was the deputy editor-in-chief of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. Next is Shiza Francis, who's a recent graduate from WashU School of Law in St. Louis, where she served as president of the Federalist Society student chapter and as a research assistant for Professor Connor Clark. She's entering into private practice now, and she'll be clerking next year. Aaron Watt is a law clerk for the Honorable Judge Brian Miller on the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Arkansas, graduated from Scalia Law School, George Mason, where he was president of the Federalist Society student chapter there. So without further ado, I will ask Eric Bush to start off our conversation.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction into the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate on this panel. I've attended many Federalist Society panels over the years. In fact, I think my first Federalist Society event was when I was 12 years old. I learned then that I could join as a student member for $5, and I mailed in a $5 bill, and I've been a member ever since. So it's really an honor to now be on the other side participating in this panel. I probably don't need to explain to this audience how important the topic of standing is. Because of the case and controversy requirement, the issue of who can sue is often just as important as the underlying merits. Nor do I need to tell you how perplexing the standing doctrine can be, but hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on recent developments on this panel. Today, I'm going to focus my remarks on organizational and associational standing. I will mainly discuss the FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case from last term. Courts and litigants don't always use the terms organizational and associational standing consistently, so let me just briefly define how I will use them. When I refer to organizational standing, what I mean is when an organization itself has been injured and asserts that injury. And when I refer to associational standing, I mean when an organization asserts an injury suffered by one or more of its members, but not necessarily by the organization itself. Last term in FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, the court touched on both of those topics. In that case, four pro-life medical groups, along with individual physicians, challenged several FDA actions regarding the approval of mifepristone, a drug used for medicated abortions. The plaintiffs challenged the FDA's approval of the drug and subsequent orders relaxing the conditions under which it could be prescribed. The plaintiffs initially prevailed at the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas, which enjoined each of the challenged FDA actions and ordered the drug off the market. The Fifth Circuit partially stayed the district court's injunction, and then the Supreme Court fully stayed the district court's injunction. Eventually, the case made it back to the Supreme Court on the merits, where the court unanimously held that the plaintiffs lacked standing. Justice Kavanaugh wrote the opinion of the court. The principal standing issue was whether the plaintiffs, as unregulated third parties, could establish causation. The court held that neither the individual nor organizational plaintiffs could do so. The individual physicians argued that the FDA's approval of the drug might require doctors to render emergency treatment, completing the abortions, or providing other abortion-related treatment against the doctor's consciences. But Justice Kavanaugh explained that even if the challenged FDA actions result in additional emergency abortion-related care, federal conscience laws definitively protect doctors from being required to perform abortions or to provide other treatment that violates their consciences. Second, the individual physicians argued that they would suffer monetary injuries from having to treat patients with mifepristone complications. The court rejected that argument as too speculative. Justice Kavanaugh posited that if the court accepted that theory, then a doctor who treats patients for asthma could challenge an EPA admissions rule, or a pediatrician might be able to challenge the constitutionality of a middle school football team on account of having to treat players for concussions. Next, the court considered the medical association's organizational standing argument. The associations claim that the FDA has impaired their ability to provide services and achieve their organizational missions. Specifically, the organizations claim to have incurred a financial injury in conducting their own studies on mifepristone, expending considerable time, energy, and resources drafting citizen petitions to FDA, as well as engaging in public advocacy and public education. According to the associations, all of this was to the detriment of their other spending priorities. This theory of standing is known as diversion of resources standing. Essentially, an organization claims a direct injury on account of having to spend resources fighting against a policy it disagrees with. Diversion of resources standing is based off of language from the 1982 case Havens Realty versus Coleman. In that case, a housing counseling and referral service named Home sent two of its employees, one black and one white, to inquire about apartment vacancies at properties owned by Havens. Havens told the black employee that there were no vacancies, while it told the white employee that there were apartments available. Home sued Havens for violating the Fair Housing Act, which created a right to truthful information about housing availability. In addition to the informational injury, Havens also impaired Home's ability to provide counseling and referral services for low and moderate home seekers. The court held that Home had standing. Several circuits have read Havens broadly to stand for the proposition that if an organization expends resources in response to and to counteract the effects of the defendant's unlawful conduct, then that organization has standing. The only limit is that diversion of resources must be for more than mere litigation expenses to challenge the allegedly unlawful conduct. The Court in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine decisively rejected the diversion of resources theory. Justice Kavanaugh described Havens as an unusual case that the court has declined to extend beyond its context. He further noted that Holmes' injury impacted its core business, its housing referral service, not unlike a retailer who sues a manufacturer for selling defective goods to that retailer. By contrast, according to the court, FDA's actions relaxing regulation of mifepristone have not imposed any similar impediment to the medical association's advocacy businesses. Justice Kavanaugh further noted that unlike the Havens plaintiffs, the Alliance didn't assert an informational injury such as that the FDA failed to disclose information it was required to disseminate. So what are the implications of the organizational standing holding in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine? Already, the Sixth Circuit has relied on Alliance to stay an injunction against certain voter registration procedures, finding that the organizational plaintiff, in that case, the NAACP, likely lacks standing based on its diversion of resources theory. The Supreme Court's decision to close the door on diversion of resources standing is likely to make it much harder for unregulated advocacy organizations to challenge policies they dislike. It won't be possible for an organization to merely spend its way into standing. At a minimum, an unregulated organization will have to show that a challenged policy impacts the organization's core operations in a foreseeable way. Finally, I'd like to briefly touch on Justice Thomas's concurrence in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. Justice Thomas wrote separately to share his view that the court's associational standing doctrine is both unconstitutional and normatively undesirable. Recall that associational standing is when an organization asserts standing based on an injury to its members without there necessarily being an injury to the organization itself. Justice Thomas explains two constitutional problems he sees with associational standing. First, he argues that associational standing violates Article 3 by allowing a third party to assert the rights of others. In the context of organizational standing, an organization does this by asserting the injury of one of its members and not of itself. And second, the associational standing doctrine sanctions courts to grant broad injunctive relief for all of an organization's members, not just the injured ones. For example, consider an organization like AARP, which has tens of millions of members. AARP could challenge a policy based on the injury of a single member, yet obtain relief for all its members. This violates what Justice Thomas thinks is a critical limitation on the court's remedial authority, that it must tailor its remedies to the injuries of the parties actually before it. Justice Thomas also raises several non-constitutional concerns with associational standing. First, he compares associational standing to class actions, explaining that both class actions and associational standing share the same goal of providing relief to a large group of people. Yet in class actions, plaintiffs must prove that the injury is widely shared, while associational standing only requires a single member to be injured. Class actions must also demonstrate that a case is better resolved through representative litigation than through individual litigation, where there's no analogous burden for associational standing. Second, associational standing might allow plaintiffs two bites at the apple. Under the doctrine of claim preclusion, once a party litigates and loses an issue or claim, it can be barred from reasserting the same issue or claim in another suit. But under associational standing, the organization, not the injured member, is the party before the court. So if the organization loses, it seems that the injured member might be able to then bring an individual suit based on the same claims the organization just lost on. No other justice joined Justice Thomas in his concurrence, and it's uncertain to what extent other justices might be willing to reevaluate the associational standing doctrine. During the 2022-23 term, the court briefly discussed associational standing in Students for Fair Admissions. In that case, the university defendants argued that Students for Fair Admissions wasn't a bona fide organization. The court rejected that argument, and along the way, it didn't cast any doubt on the broader associational standing doctrine. But it's worth noting that the implications might be significant if the court decided to reevaluate associational standing, because some of the most high-profile cases before the court are brought by associations that get into court on associational standing. So what should we take away from Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine? First, I think this case fits within a larger trend of the court trying to narrow its role in resolving policy disputes. Justice Kavanaugh described standing as a mechanism to implement the properly limited role of courts in a democratic society. He explains that by limiting who can sue, the standing requirement means that the federal courts decide some contested legal questions later rather than sooner, or even not at all. This allows issues to percolate and potentially be resolved by the political branches in the democratic process. Applying that view to Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, Justice Kavanaugh suggested the challengers in that case would be better off taking their concerns to the executive and legislative branches. Second, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine provides further evidence that the court is not outcome-driven towards conservative priorities. Here, the court declined to weigh in on an issue important to many conservatives. The court did the same thing in Murthy, a First Amendment challenge to social media content moderation, and also an important issue for many conservatives. I think these cases demonstrate that the court will use the standing doctrine in an ideological neutral manner to avoid resolving contested policy issues. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to hearing from the other panelists.
Thanks so much, Eric. I think what's interesting with, especially building on your points with Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA, is that that court was unanimous, 9-0. And Murthy versus Missouri, a little bit more fractured, that was 6-3. But I think another point I want to draw is that Justice Kavanaugh has had a pretty significant stake in defining standing for the court. He authored TransUnion versus Ramirez in 2021, U.S. versus Texas in 2023. So maybe we'll talk about that just a little bit later. Next, we have Shiza.
Yes. Thank you, Aram, for being our moderator and for the Federalist Society for hosting this. Touching upon what Aram noted, I'm going to be talking about one component of standing relating to intangible injuries and the major case that really started what is percolating through the circuit courts now is TransUnion, which was decided in 2021. And it was about what kind of harm was required to have Article III standing in order to recover damages for a statutory violation. Ever since Justice Scalia created the three-part test in Lujan, the federal courts have wrestled with the question of when a violation of statutory rights satisfies the injury in fact requirement, and more specifically, the requirement for concrete harm. So the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 opinion authored by Justice Kavanaugh, stated that only about 1,800 or so of the 8,000 class members suffered a concrete harm because only they had misleading information about them shared with the third party business. The mere existence of misleading information about whether a consumer was on the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control list of terrorists, drug traffickers, and serious criminals was not enough in itself to have a concrete injury, even though being mistaken as someone on that list is can be damaging to any consumer. The test that the court articulated for plaintiffs to demonstrate standing is that they would have to identify a close historical or common law analog for their asserted injury that is traditionally recognized as providing a basis for a lawsuit in the American courts. And the key language that the circuits since TransUnion have really debated is the language where Justice Kavanaugh says that there's no exact duplicate that is required in American history and tradition, but that Spokio and TransUnion shouldn't be taken as an open invitation to the federal courts to loosen the Article III requirements. So the debate has been about what the balance is and how close or analogous does the plaintiff have to be to a common law tort or contract infraction. The cases post-TransUnion have mostly been about the disclosure of sensitive information to another party. And we're seeing this both in the form of class A actions and via individual plaintiffs. Two of the cases that I'll be focusing on that demonstrate the two different approaches are the cases from the 11th Circuit and from the 3rd Circuit. Hunstein v. Preferred Collection Management Services, which in other opinions has been labeled Hunstein 3 since there's been three of them. From the 11th Circuit adopts the element for element approach. It was decided shortly after TransUnion, and most, if not all, of the circuits have referenced it. The other case worth highlighting is Barcliff versus Keystone Credit Services from the Third Circuit that adopted the kind of harm approach. It was decided in February 2024, so it's the most recent of the decisions in the circuits, and it's also pending cert before the Supreme Court. In Hunstein, the procedural posture of Hunstein was that the Middle District of Florida dismissed plaintiff's complaint, and the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded, and then the case went en banc. The plaintiff alleged that a debt collection agency violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act when it electronically submitted sensitive information about the medical debt incurred from the treatment of the plaintiff's son to a third-party vendor for printing to send back to the plaintiff to remind them about their debt obligations. The underlying act makes it illegal to disclose this kind of information to a third party without their consent. So the majority opinion authored by Judge Grant stated that essentially plaintiff had just a mere legal injury and it wasn't sufficient to have Article III standing. They failed to demonstrate two key elements that were needed to show to be analogous to the claim of invasion of privacy, which was the common law analog that the plaintiff decided to go with. One of the requirements is the disclosure for publicity, and they said that this just wasn't there when you disclose to a vendor who then just basically takes a ministerial role in reminding the plaintiff about their obligations. The Third Circuit interpreted TransUnion to require a comparison of elements in traditional common law claims to determine if the harm caused by the statute was sufficiently similar. They did acknowledge that this does mean that the lower courts kind of have to fit square causes of actions into round torts, but that is how they interpret the mandate from TransUnion. And so in this instance, the invasion of privacy required publicity, which just didn't occur. There was a lot of disagreement about how charitable to take the pleadings at this stage. And Judge Newsom's dissent in this case was particularly noteworthy. It built on his prior concurrences about his view of standing and the relationship between Article III standing and about what practices the courts have, the historical practices of the courts at the time of the founding, which are a little bit more distinct. Judge Pryor also had a concurrence in that. There's actually been a lot of discussion about a footnote in TransUnion, footnote 6, about whether disclosing to an intermediary is enough for publicity. And Judge Pryor really dug a little bit more into the requirements to make something analogous. The other case from the Third Circuit is Barcliff v. Keystone, and essentially the Third Circuit took a looser approach to what qualifies as an analog, and they stated that there doesn't need to be an element for element match. Really, the harm just has to be similar in kind, and the harm just has to be similar in kind. The procedural posture for that case was that the district court dismissed the complaint and for lack of standing, and the Court of Appeals affirmed but instructed the district court to dismiss without prejudice. A consumer brought a punitive class action against a collection agency alleging a violation of the Fair Debt Credit Collection Practices Act when it, again, shared personal information to a third-party mailing vendor without their consent. The in-kind test, again, is really a looser test that essentially states that if the kind of harm is the same, even though to a lesser degree, then a plaintiff does have standing. For instance, they talk about other cases where a few pesky text messages is sufficient for standing. It's sufficient for the common law analog that was used in that case. The Judge Mady also had an interesting dissent in that case, where he really goes into what his theory or where the direction of standing needs to go a little bit. He essentially states that standing needs a rewrite and that the majority took a little bit too much from the dicta in TransUnion. He also discussed a little bit about the founding era analysis and how Lujan is really ahistoric. And he discussed a little bit, like Aram touched upon, about the development of administrative law and how it affects standing. And his major thesis was that public and private rights should be treated different. That if a Congress grants a cause of action for a purely private right, then that legal injury should really be sufficient. But that for public rights, something more probably should be required. And that's what his analysis of history and tradition brought him to that conclusion. And so in this like area, there's a few big picture things about how these line of cases really fit in with the broader overview of standing. It's important to note that in TransUnion, the majority really didn't buy the United States argument that this kind of injury should be categorized as an informational injury, like in FEC versus Adkins. And every opinion has talked about the balance of power between Article III courts and Congress and how much Congress can really decide the jurisdiction of the courts.
Well, thanks so much, Shiza. It's really fun to see you that deeply with TransUnion. And this, of course, reminds me of Spokio versus Robbins, a 2015 case, and it's a very strong majority sort of laying out this distinction between concreteness and particularization, and then this is a build off of it. So the other point that I at least want to draw as we then transition to Aaron is that there's so much material here. It's just impossible to discuss in an hour, right? There's U.S. versus Texas, the Department of Education versus Brown, Holland versus Bracken, Uzugbunam versus Przewski in 2021. We're not going to be able to cover these, but I do like that, you know, like at least we're touching on the major big cases that really have a significant implication in administrative law. So next, Aaron is up.
Thank you, Professor Gubor, and thank you for everyone from the Federalist Society and from the Administrative Law Practice Group leadership team for putting this together. I didn't realize how much work goes into one of these until I ended up on the other side of the panel.
It's a Fed Courts Article III jurisdiction one, right? So this is a particularly high standard.
Nice, I like it. Today I'm going to talk about two different topics. I'm going to talk about state standing, and then I'm going to talk about causation. And the two are going to kind of run into each other because I'm going to talk about Murthy, Missouri, a fair amount, and state standing and causation both come up in that recent decision quite a bit. Turning to state standing, before I get into recent decisions, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about what state standing is and how it differs from private party standing. States sometimes have interests that are different than private parties. States have a sovereign interest. They would have a sovereign interest in protecting things like their borders or their waterways. Those are historic reasons why a state would have standing, especially in suing each other. It's somewhat distinct when the states seek to sue the federal government. They have what's called a parens patriae rationale for doing so. States can sometimes sue under this rationale. Translated, parens patriae means a parent of the nation. So similar to what Eric was talking about earlier, when associations represent the interests of their members, a state can represent the interests of its citizens. And it's a bit of a heightened interest compared to organizations, because the state does have some legitimate paternal interest in protecting its citizens. These interests can give them standing to sue. The Supreme Court allows states to sue the federal government under that rationale, as long as the state has some sort of interest of its own that runs alongside the interests of the affected citizens. That makes it a quasi-sovereign interest. 3 years of law school taught me that anytime you see the word quasi attached to another word, it means that no one understands it. And so to know what it is, we will look at it through some examples. These sorts of cases also were not common in the early years of the Republic. As late as 1920, the Supreme Court shot down a 10th Amendment challenge asserted by the state of Massachusetts against the federal government, arguing or saying that it didn't have standing. There were some consequential cases between then running up to 1995. And in 1995, the Supreme Court allowed the state of Wyoming to sue the United States in a water rights case. The water rights injury to Wyoming citizens was found to be a quasi-sovereign interest of the state. And then the big decision was Massachusetts versus EPA in 2007. This was arguably a massive expansion in state standing. In Massachusetts v. EPA, the court allowed them to sue the EPA because of a future threat to its coastline due to climate change. Massachusetts argued that the EPA's failure to regulate carbon dioxide emissions contributed to greenhouse gases, and those gases increased global warming, which threatened the Massachusetts coastline. There was a lot of debate between the majority and the dissent as to whether or not sufficient causation could be established by the EPA's lack of actions moving into the climate crisis and then the actual increase of the water in the coastlines of Massachusetts. And perhaps even more compellingly from the dissent's part, there was an argument about whether the court could actually redress the problem as to whether or not deciding favorably for Massachusetts would solve Massachusetts' threat to its coastline. But moving through these things, the court found that because Massachusetts was suing on behalf of its citizens, it should receive what was called special solicitude in the standing analysis. And so it's left a lot of people wondering how far this special solicitude actually extended and what it was. I take a look next at a decision that Professor Gabor has already mentioned, which was a big decision in deciding what special solicitude was not, and that was the United States v. Texas. In this case, the Texas challenged the Department of Homeland Security, which made rules deciding not to enforce particular detention and deportation laws in some situations in order to prioritize other actions. Texas argued it was damaged by the decision of the federal government would have to expend more arresting and detaining individuals and sued to invalidate the rule. And the Supreme Court held that the Supreme Court didn't have jurisdiction to review the executive's decision because it fell within the executive's enforcement discretion. And so enforcement discretion is a broadly accepted principle. But I just want to look for a second at the rationale given by the Supreme Court for extending special solicitude to begin with. And the court in Massachusetts v. EPA said, when a state enters the union, it surrenders certain sovereign prerogatives. Massachusetts cannot invade Rhode Island to force reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. It cannot negotiate an emissions treaty with China or India. And in some circumstances, the exercise of its police powers to reduce in-state motor vehicle emissions might well be preempted. And it said, one helpful indication is determining whether an alleged injury to the health and welfare of citizens suffices to give the state standing to sue parens patriae is whether the injury is one that the state, if it could, would likely attempt to address through its sovereign lawmaking powers. And so one of the things that, of course, is unique about United States versus Texas is this was an issue over border security and immigration. And this is certainly a core right of a nation that was given up when Texas came into the nation. And so if the court was going to extend this rationale, the special solicitude, this seems like a case where it may have been likely to do that. But instead, the court did rule against Texas on the enforcement discretion rationale 8-1. Moving forward from United States v. Texas, we take a look at Murthy versus McCarthy. In Murthy versus McCarthy, two states and five private parties sued the federal government to enjoin it from censoring their online speech. This was a significant free speech case. Justice Alito in dissent said of the case, if the lower court's assessment of the voluminous record is correct, this is one of the most important free speech cases to reach this court in years. I'll just mention that it's unique in political history. I often talk with my friends who talk about some of the disagreement and foment and political unrest. And when we look across history, it's actually not that unique as much as it is troubling what we experience. But what is unique in our time is the concentration of information within social media companies and the interaction of that between the government and the First Amendment. And so it presents a new concern. Also, Murthy is important because it deals with political speech. The plaintiffs alleged that speech regarding the elections was censored. And it's sort of political speech, at least I find, is the first among equals when it comes to protections under the First Amendment. The majority didn't let us know what they thought about the actions, particularly of the government, but it did discuss standing at length. When we look back at our discussion earlier, we see that in order to assert parents patriae standing, a state must have a sovereign interest in common with the litigants. Here, Missouri and Louisiana asserted that their state officials were censored at the urging of the federal government. The court, however, noted the pleadings didn't indicate the date of the federal government coercion or the date of the censorship. Without a timeline, the states couldn't prove a causal relationship. Without that, the state had no quasi-sovereign interest in common with its citizens. The state was merely suing on behalf of its citizens, which is historically not allowed under prior precedents. And so this causation question arises again and again in Murthy. Much like the states, the court notes the individual plaintiffs failed to establish government coercion occurred prior to the censorship. In other places, the court didn't accept that a causal relationship existed when the first instance of censorship occurred before government coercion of the social media companies began. This suggests that any increase in censorship by the social media companies after government coercion started couldn't be attributed to the government. And even still, the court notes some instances where no censorship began until the government started its campaign of pressure. Even here, the court was unwilling to accept that there was a causal relationship because the social media companies also censored on their own and found that the two were often indistinguishable. And so Murthy versus McCarthy could have significant implications moving forward for First Amendment, but importantly for standing. It's a very tight causal relationship test. And as I was thinking about this decision, I was reminded we don't have as much experience as a lot of the panelists here at the Federalist Society, but one thing I do have is I'm closer to law school than most of the panelists. And so I wanted to just throw out a hypothetical that sometimes it's not a hypothetical, but we bring it up in crim law. And it talks about, because we usually talk about these things in terms of either proximate cause or but-for causation when we're trying to determine whether an action was the cause of something. And so you'll remember there's some exceptions to that. One of the hypotheticals we talked about in crim law was if two people each set a fire and then both of those fires combine and then that fire then advances and does something like burn this down a house. Well, how do you decide whose fire caused the house to burn down? And in that circumstance, the correct causation test is determining whether or not it was a substantial factor. And so in Murthy versus Missouri, the court advanced a very tight causation test, one that litigants will have to think a lot about moving forward. It seemed like in Murthy versus Missouri, the government censorship activity flowed together with private social media company censorship activity, and the two streams became indistinguishable. It is an interesting contrast how in the crim law context, the arson doesn't get off the hook because the two fires combined. But it appears that in the First Amendment context, that litigants are going to have to be able to distinguish between government censorship and private censorship when the two are cooperating together if they want to be able to achieve standing. And so on that note, I'll hand it back to our moderator.
Thanks so much, Aaron. Really fascinating discussion. And again, what I really want to stress, at least from my observation quantitatively, is that with some exceptions, TransUnion and then Murthy, the Supreme Court's acting with very strong majorities, 7-2, 8-1, 9-0, for a lot of these cases. So that's just a big point to throw out as I transition us into talking about the broader milieu and what this means with regard to administrative law. One other observation that I wanted to draw is that it seems that Massachusetts versus EPA is more of the outlier, almost the Goldberg versus Kelly, the jurisdiction equivalent, for due process. And at least many observe that that special solicitude framework was really designed to earn the vote of Justice Kennedy, who had very, very strong views on state rights. Because otherwise, that case, where you have perhaps the most difficult to establish causation requirement, which is Massachusetts coastline receding by failure of the EPA to regulate a particular greenhouse gas. And then you have to keep in mind, global warming is a worldwide phenomenon, right? So is EPA's regulation of CO2 causing the actual coastline of Massachusetts to cede, and by how much? That wouldn't comport with many of the other cases that you were just describing today. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to then transition this, because this is the admin law practice group, to what this all means for administrative law. It seems that we have a bit of a juxtaposition here, where the broader milieu with regard to the court's opinions involving administrative law tends to be somewhat administrative law skeptical. Not trying to put a politicized term on it, but Kaiser versus Wilkie, rendering our deference from 1997 or Seminole Rock essentially into a nullity and almost impossible to establish test in 2019. West Virginia versus EPA in 2022, laying out a strong statutory version of the major questions doctrine. Axon versus the Federal Trade Commission 2023, involving the permission or the authority or capability of a regulated party to challenge the constitutionality of an agency action outside of the Section 704 finality framework. Starbucks versus McKinney 2024, laying out that the four-part equitable test for preliminary injunction does need to also apply to the NLRB and its orders. SEC versus Jericho, requiring that certain claims for civil violations and civil damages need to go to a jury trial. And then, of course, Corner Post versus the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve this term, laying out an especially muscular and broad vision of what a statute of limitations is, allowing the regulated parties to challenge conduct that occurred that maybe several years prior, 20, 30 years, but if you just establish a business now and the old rule harms you now, you can challenge the old rule on a facial basis. So you have that direction, but then at the same time, you have this opposing direction, at least from the pictures that you paint, that the Supreme Court is saying, well, that's not really a case. Organizational standing, that doesn't make so much sense anymore. This might even be unconstitutional, using the Justice Thomas framework. And then also concreteness and causation, really tightening the wrenches on that. So how does this fill in? What does this mean for administrative law? Let me go with, let's say, Shiza first, then Aaron, and then Eric.
That is a tough question to start with. But I think
I didn't preview the questions with the discussants. This is the real. Okay.
I think Jarkissi stands out to me as having probably the most real world impact on regulated parties. Prior to Jarkissi, the chances of winning at the SEC were very low. And now that those structures need to be changed, I'm sure that the agencies will respond accordingly. And with regulated parties, it's not the same as injury regarding, you know, First Amendment, freedom of religion, that it's like it either occurred or didn't occur and the litigant wants to sue or not sue. They're really dollar values that a client will go up until, and then that's essentially after that, it doesn't necessarily make sense. So I think that in terms of the developments in administrative law, Jarkissi, in my opinion, will probably have the most real world impact. And what was the second part of your question?
Well, I guess the core of the question is, what does what appears to be a contraction of standing jurisprudence for allowing the regulated public to gain access to the federal courts, and then the expansion of individual rights once you're in court, what does that mean? It's the big question. We're up in the sky. Where do you see this headed?
Right. I think that what it will really mean is that there might be fewer claims or types of injuries that the court will acknowledge, but those injuries will be very solid. So it'll kind of be like calcifying. You either have it or you don't, not any of this like gray area on the spectrum, I think, but it's also just a big question. And we have to see what direction the court takes it and how the lower courts and the agencies react.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'd add to that just by saying that a through line with all of these different decisions that you're mentioning is that if you are the regulated party, the one that's actually suffered the injury, you should be able to get in court, even if, you know, it was a long time ago since the administrative action that you're challenging occurred, for example. Where it is a lot harder is if you're an advocacy organization that may not have as direct a stake in what's going on. I think it's interesting to note Justice Kavanaugh is not saying that he wants to necessarily close the door to resolving disputed policy positions, but he really does want to narrow who is the right person to do that. And I think what Chizza was saying about calcifying the plaintiffs that you have coming before the court seems very true. Have the right people come in who have the most at stake and are going to be the best litigants if we are going to be taking on a contested public policy issue.
Thank you. Aaron?
Well, I thought there was two things that came to mind when you asked the question. One is just kind of identifying that incremental approach the court often takes, whether it's moving forward or moving away from something. And so I think the move in that direction without overturning anything necessarily is still an indicator that the court is headed in a way, especially using language like it may be unconstitutional in some of these things. And so, I mean, if you're a litigant that expects all the way to go all the way to the Supreme Court, then it's probably a pretty strong signal that if the jurisprudence is moving away from you, then you may not fare too well in your to get standing at the Supreme Court. But that said, I think because it is an incremental approach and they are not overturning some of these other cases, that a lot of action is going to be decided within the circuits. And so these kind of standing precedents are all there to choose from. And circuit judges and district judges are going to have to select the standing precedent that they think fits the best. And so until some of these things bubble up, and they may be like the lemon test where the dreaded ghoul walks around for the standing standards for a while until the court finally resolves the incrementalism by overturning some things. But I suspect that's where the action will be.
That's a fair point. And also I want to note, the Supreme Court isn't overturning standing jurisprudence here. It's just evolving it. And also, this is just my own views, is that modern standing jurisprudence is a creature of essentially the 1970s and beyond, and we're still moving forward on it. What's interesting to me is you just all graduated law school, and the materials that you studied, both in administrative law and in federal courts and perhaps constitutional law, it's not really, it's more like sand, and you just have to be able to stay agile and maneuver with it. So then the next question I want to ask is, certainly with regard to the administrative law milieu, there's been a lot of arguments that the Supreme Court is politicizing things. Do you see that evidence with regard to standing jurisprudence? I'll do a free-form discussion now.
Well, I think I touched on this a little bit at the end of my prepared remarks, that certainly the Supreme Court's recent standing cases have not necessarily reached outcomes that would align with, you know, any one ideological view. The case that I discussed and then Murthy that Aaron discussed, those are reaching, you know, outcomes that maybe a lot of legal conservatives wouldn't agree with. I guess you could approach it with a more legal realist perspective that the Supreme Court is, using standing as a way to sort of cool things down while deciding other more contentious issues. I don't think I subscribe to that view. I think that the Supreme Court really is trying to apply the standing doctrine in an ideologically neutral way and has been fairly successful at doing that in the last few terms.
And I'll add to what Eric said that in relation to the Mifepristone cases and the abortion cases pre-Dobbs, there was a criticism among some of the justices that that doctors and other third parties were granted standing when they really shouldn't have had standing in the abortion context. So you can see what is happening specifically in that field is kind of like a correction from something that was politicized, where the distinction between what interests a doctor has and what interests a patient has sometimes do not converge. And I think it's a good thing for the court to reevaluate that.
Not sure that I have a lot to add. I think that the point about, the question's hanging out there, whether or not this court is using standing jurisprudence to cool things down. And I tend to agree with the other panelists that may not be the case. But the interesting kind of problem that it presents is that standing jurisprudence was expanded. And so now that a lot of conservative litigants have tried to use the standing criteria that has been set from the Supreme Court, they're having the door closed on them. And so so it creates kind of a situation where conservative litigants are wondering why they're not having access to the same criteria that perhaps people with opposing views did over the last decade or two. And they may not necessarily be because of political pressure as much as the court is trying to make a course correction.
That makes sense. I mean, to me, it looks like politics aren't involved here, right? This is just the court deciding cases. And also to me, it seems like this is just really the influence of Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett on the court. Justice Kavanaugh authored TransUnion, U.S. versus Texas, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, Justice Barrett, Holland versus Bracken, Murthy versus Missouri. So it's really their influence, I think, on the court that has a significant component here. So what I'd like to do is just have an open discussion, but also to invite our audience to ask questions at will. We have about 5 minutes left, and I'd be happy to give franchise to the audience to ask questions and potentially to have them answered. So I guess that while we're waiting for the audience questions to come in, if any, my question for this group is, what would the typical strategic issue litigator need to do now to gain access to that broader anti-administrativist milieu, but still get into court? And I think Eric touched upon it, individuals. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the most direct way to court is definitely through an economic injury or some sort of physical injury. That's really the gold standard. And then all of the other standing cases have been something, or all the contested cases have been something other than those two. So I think that those would be the direct shots and how likely you are to get your case heard.
Yeah, it's almost like an anti-beltway, anti-state capital body of jurisprudence that the Supreme Court is laying out, really a return to traditional private rights. Eric, Aaron?
Well, I think that the door is still very much open for associations to assert the injuries of its members. Although Justice Kavanaugh has raised some serious concerns with the court's doctrine in that area, there's no clear indication at the moment that the associational standing doctrine is going anywhere anytime soon. As we just saw it implicitly affirmed in Students for Fair Admissions, with the court not even really contesting the underlying doctrine at all in that case. Back to what you had said, Professor, about I think that going forward, though, the most surefire way to get into court is going to be having individuals. A lot of litigants, particularly corporate litigants, for example, may prefer to litigate through trade groups to avoid being the direct parties before the court. I think that's still possible now, but it may be that the actual injured parties themselves are going to have to step forward in a more direct way going forward.
Thank you. So we got a couple questions in for the audience in a couple of minutes within which to answer them. The first one is, what to do about the standing issue in presidential removal power cases? The court appears to believe that the existence of an unconstitutional removal provision does not harm the subject of an enforcement action. See Collins versus Yellen. Is that right? Any takers? That's okay. By the way, audience, recognize that these are freshly minted lawyers, and they've only had a couple of years to develop the law and their understanding of it.
I think to take a quick stab at it, there we go. We may have talked about this one a little bit, and it is interesting. Justice Thomas certainly advocated the position that they may not be entitled to standing for those constitutional issues. And certainly litigants have successfully challenged some of these constitutional structures and spent tons of money on it and have won and had the entire constitutional arrangement of the agency reset and then gotten no protection for themselves from the case. And so there's some interesting things that are emerging about that. I would say keep your eyes peeled for another FedSoc panel on that topic, possibly someday.
That sounds great. And also keep in mind, just the breadth of this subject is really, 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 really broad. We have time for one more question. And this is just about the emergence and prevalence of state's attorneys general over the past 20 years. And what I'll add is also state solicitor general's office. What do you think their role is, Eric? And then we'll conclude.
Well, I think, this may touch on some of what Aaron discussed, but I think maybe their role will be a bit more narrow in the future in terms of actually having to link their cases to a sovereign interest and not just showing up to raise, the same arguments that, like a trade association might be raising. So definitely we'll have to focus more on what makes a state a unique litigant rather than just challenging policies, that the state may dislike.
And I'll just add to what Eric said, the states generally can demonstrate at least some sort of economic loss, whether it's like in the student loan cases where Missouri controlled Mohila as the entity that collect the student loan payments, or one case in Florida about the cruise lines that really impacted the amount of revenue that each of the that basically the entire the exporting and importing industry was going to collect. And so I think that still is yet to be determined, but I think that again the economic injury, if that could be demonstrated, then I think the courts would be really open to granting standing for states.
Well, thanks so much, Shiza, Eric, Aaron. You're all definitely going places. Really appreciate you taking the time, and also to our audience for listening to this really incisive conversation. I'll hand it over to Kayla now.
I'll echo those thanks to you all. Really appreciate you taking this time both to prep for this program and then to spend this section of your days sharing your expertise and insight. Thank you also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.